Welcome back, everyone, to the Prepared Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Austin, and have a bit of a different episode for you guys this week. You know, we spent a lot of time talking here on the pod about preparedness, fieldcraft, survival, shooting, right? Training, gear, all that good stuff, you know, and it's really important. Obviously, that's one of our primary goals and missions here is to spread that kind of awareness and the knowledge that comes with a lot of those things and bring on guests that are able to provide their experience, share the benefit of their experience, that is, their insight, right? The lessons learned in various roles and capacities, right? We've had a lot of folks on in law enforcement, a lot of folks that have had, current and previous military histories and experience, and now have turned over to the teaching realm and things. And certainly we like to stay with that theme because I think that's why a lot of you guys are here. But it's always really fun for me when we can find these sort of, I'll say like community adjacent topics that are still very much a part of what folks like you and I are super interested in, really want to hear about, really want to learn about, but and then also, you know, really have a passion for spending our own money on and learning about and becoming subject experts to some degree in our own right. And certainly, I think that's what we're getting into with this week's discussion as I'm sitting down with Kevin from Brigade Watches. And watches are part of the community, guys, whether you realize it or not. If you look at posts, if you talk to some of the people that are out there doing this stuff, watches are a huge part of our community, from, you know, the guys that are former team dudes that wear the Rolexes and whatnot to, you know, there's so many different styles and approaches and ways to, wear a watch, use a watch, the stuff you like. I mean, we got people with $50 G-Shocks and you got guys running around there with, you know, $15,000 Rolexes and everything in between. Certainly stuff from companies like Tag and Citizen, Seiko. You know, I wear a Glycine combat sub, and that's been my daily driver for two or three years now. Got it on closeout at Costco. It wasn't like the model was discontinued; it was one of those deals. I don't know if you guys seen this online, where they put the little asterisk on the sales placard, and that means that they won't be restocking that. And usually, when they do that, they cut prices like 10 or 15%. Below what it already was, and usually Costco, you guys know Costco, is very affordable, and that's why a lot of people like it. You get a lot of good deals on things like technology, TVs, and laptops, but also you can get some pretty cool watches there from time to time. And I had been looking for a combat sub since the days, like the original days, or at least older days, of Drop.com. If you guys aren't familiar with Drop, it was a website that used to do like limited run collaborations with certain knife makers and watch companies, all kinds of like really, really cool EDC stuff. And I have a EDC caddy and a watch case that my wife got for me as for Christmas gifts from there. I think one was a Christmas gift, and I think one was either an anniversary or birthday gift. But really, really cool, like limited run items that were really into the EDC space. And I loved their site. And I first came across the Glycine Combat Sub on that website. And it was like $350 or $400. I was going to say $400. Yeah, it's been a long day. I originally came across their stuff there and was like, man, I would really love one of those. And then they never came back in stock. And then if you guys have kept up on Drop.com, some of you guys probably have, they became kind of like an audiophile and technology type site. They do like super like high spec keyboards and headphones and stuff like that. Really got away from the EDC space. Unfortunately, it was something that I really, really loved. But watches are a thing where I know many of us have a passion for them, or at least an interest. We just, you know, kind of like this community in this space, we don't really know where to go when we get started. And there's so many different things to know and learn, you know, quartz movement versus automatic movements. When you get into the automatic movements, different companies make different, you know, mechanisms and movements. And you have things like quartz, you have crystal glass, you have all kinds of materials used to actually make the watches. You have terms thrown around like dive watches and tool watches. And there's, you know, GMTs and chronographs and all that stuff. And certainly it can get a little bit confusing. And if you're willing to put the time in, you can very easily, at a high level, I'll say, learn and understand why some of these watches function the way they do. And I certainly think that dive watches have kind of I'll say like whittled out a place in the heart of our community. You see a lot of folks running divers, whether that's a Citizen or a Seiko, or obviously, yes, like a Rolex Submariner or some of the variations of Rolex that are very popular that look somewhat similar to that. And I think every company, you know, has their version of that kind of watch. I know for Omega, it's the Seamaster, which I personally really, really like. And that's, I don't actually want a Submariner from Rolex. My personal grail watch would be an Omega Seamaster. I like the aesthetic behind it. For me, you know, I just don't know that it gets any better. And certainly, you know, I don't know anything about Omega. So people could be like, oh yeah, they're not great. Or, oh, you're overpaying, go get a Tudor or something like that. And Tudor makes good watches too. But, we're going to get into watches, man, because Kevin has, you know, a lot of knowledge to share. We're going to talk about why watches are actually interesting and necessary in field applications, because anything and everything from what you can use them for in survival situations to why they're necessary for obvious things like probably field planning and operations planning and things like that. You got to know what time it is. That's important. And as much as people rely on cell phones these days, cell phones, if they lose connectivity, they're not reliable. If the battery runs out, then you have issues. If there's some kind of EMP, you have issues. And I think that's really why a lot of people have gotten away from the smartwatches in our community and the Apple watches, things like that, and gotten back to getting away to some degree away from the cheaper G-Shocks and stuff like that, and gone back to automatics, even quartz watches that run off a battery, right? Those become problematic because you have to change those batteries. Now they do run for a while, but usually every other year or so, your watch will be sitting there and it'll just die, right? And you'll go put it on, you'll show up. We've all had it happen, right? You go to a party, go look at your wrist and like, oh, well, this is embarrassing. My watch is dead. And then when people ask you what time it is, or hey, nice timepiece, I really like that, you know, that Movado that you're wearing, or I really like that Shinola, you know, that's a Detroit company. And people go, that, can I see it? And you're like, oh yeah, sorry. And you got to lead with, it's dead, I just realized it. But at any rate, it should be a really cool discussion, something off the beaten path for certainly what we usually get into here. I have been looking forward to it since I was able to connect with Kevin a couple months ago, honestly, casually messaged with him. I really, really like the work that Brigade is doing. They make some very, very good looking watches. And they, you know, certainly with their diver, they borrow the aesthetic a bit from, I think, the Submariner, as so many brands do. But they build it in a way that I think we'll find is probably unique to what Brigade's doing, and certainly why they do it that way. So it should be a very, very interesting conversation. But before we get into timepieces and watches and all that good stuff, you guys, we have some partners that make this podcast possible that I want to tell you all about. And certainly, I think I need to start by saying thank you to our Patreon patrons. Guys, we actually do have a Patreon. It's in our link tree on our Instagram page. And if you guys are looking for a way to support the podcast to keep these episodes going, it's been, you know, 5+ years now, and you want to make sure that we make it to 6 or 7 or 10 or whatever. If you want to go over to our Instagram page, subscribe and follow us on Instagram and YouTube if you guys aren't, because those are where we're dropping pretty much all of our content, you know, every couple of days, every week, what have you, in addition to the podcast you're listening to here. But if you want more information, you want a way to support what Prepared Mindset is, right, and help contribute to the longevity of the mission, we do have a Patreon there, and there is additional bonus content, bonus recordings like this, or recordings similar to this, not this recording. This isn't a bonus. Duh, guys. But you can go check that out. It's in our link tree, patreon.com/prepared_mindset_pod. Got a couple different tiers in there. And yeah, just another way to connect with Prepared Mindset and support what we're doing. But in addition to that, we have some awesome partners in the industry that are absolutely essential to everything we do. And I want to make sure that we take the time to say thank you to them, and that I steer you guys over to them, because in this industry, unfortunately, there's some bad actors, there's some bad apples. We want to make sure you guys are spending your money with good folks that you can trust. And that certainly starts with Custom Night Vision. You guys, actually just had a very good friend of mine go to Custom. Hey man, I am ready to get into night vision. I'm gonna take one big swing. I'm going to go to Custom Night Vision. I want, you know, a set of binos. I want a helmet. I want to go from 0 to 1. I want to make sure that when I'm walking away, I didn't miss a thing. He headed on over to CustomNightVision.com. He reached out to the team. They have a chat function that's actually built into the website in the lower right-hand corner of CustomNightVision.com. He reached out. He talked with Ben. He talked with Kevin. Hey, I like the MH1 from Lloyd Innovations, which is one of the binocular housings that Custom stocks. And if you guys look around the website there, you can certainly use their builder tool to build out a monocular or a binocular device. You can select whatever housing you like, for instance, the MH1 from Lloyd Innovations, and then you can pick out the tubes you want. You can pick out the optics you want. And again, if you are unsure, you don't know, hey, what's the difference between regular, you know, I'm air quotes here, regular L3 tubes or L3 super gain tubes or Elbit, right? Or maybe even Photonis. Hey, what's the difference? Where am I going to see the difference in the performance here? What does it mean? What are these numbers? What do the stats behind the tubes mean? What do those numbers equate to in a performance conversation? The team at Custom is there to provide the most transparent buying experience possible. And then they can additionally make recommendations on things like helmets. Hey, do you need ballistic protection? Do you want something that's just going to be light and very comfortable? The Custom actually stocks the Team Wendy helmets. So Bump, the Team Wendy Carbon, their X-Fill, the X-Fill SL, which is their lightweight helmet, and then the Epic helmet as well. So all that stuff in stock, and honestly, a whole bunch more, you guys. Strobes, lasers, flashlights, you name it. Literally your one-stop shop for all things night vision. It's customnightvision.com. Head over to the website. Check out everything they got going on. Like I said, reach out to the team there. Talk to Ben. Talk to Kevin. They will take great care of you. Let them know that Austin from Prepared Mindset sent you. Helps us out just a little bit. And certainly also want to say thank you to our friends over at Harrington Arms, you guys. So located down in Ohio, just a bit to the south of me here in Michigan, Harrington Arms is an outstanding company that, mainly produces compensators for handguns. And if you're somebody who's looking to try and improve your handgun performance, I think a compensator is a fantastic way to test the waters on upgrading your blaster. So whether, you know, you're somebody who's heard things about compensators, you've heard things about performance triggers, you've been very skeptical in the past about using any of those kinds of upgrades and enhancements, I get it, you guys. I do. I was you up until very recently. Tried their HC95 compensator on my Glock 45, and man, it was just so fun to shoot. You know, one of those whoa moments where you're like, I just enjoy shooting this more than I did. You can head on over to their website at harringtonarms.com and check it all out for yourself, whether that's a, you know, Springfield, the Palmetto Dagger, yes, of course, Glock. They make all kinds of parts and accessories, mag wells, compensators, magazine extensions. And we had Jake on just a couple weeks ago here and talking about their soon to be released, barrel and compensator combo. So again, it's harringtonarms.com. You guys head on over, check that all out for yourselves. Big thanks to both of those companies, and certainly a thanks to those of you listening that are Patreon patrons. That's a huge program that supports everything that we do here with the podcast, with the YouTube channel, and with the Instagram. So with any of those, if you guys aren't subscribed, if you're not following us, make sure you go subscribe and follow, especially the free platforms. Those numbers, you know, they help us out a ton, especially when it comes to tying content back and forth between YouTube and the podcast here and the Instagram. But like I said, folks, my guest this week is Kevin from Brigade Watch Co. And we're going to talk about watches. You know, I'm sure, at least I hope, we're going to get into things like the movement, understanding some of the more basic terms, right? Because I think when you start throwing that stuff at people like, ooh, this is a chronograph or this is a GMT, people, you know, immediately, right? You get into like the kitschy acronyms and stuff that are, you know, certainly for watch people, it's like a foregone conclusion. You understand what I'm saying to you. But for people who like the appearance of some of these watches, but don't really understand the use case behind some of them, and if, you know, certainly pilot's watches and stuff like that, where you got all sorts of stuff all over the dial, they look really cool. And some people love that aesthetic, but they don't have any clue. And by the way, it's me. I'm people. I have a Citizen Nighthawk, and I have no idea what most of the crap that's on that dial means or why it's there. But I like the aesthetic. My wife actually got me that one as a wedding present. So I love that watch. It's very near and dear to me. But tool watches, stainless steel watches, that kind of thing. Watches that are meant to be worn and used and will stand up to a beating. We're going to get into all of it. I don't even know why I'm sitting here going through all the stuff I hope we're going to talk about. We're just going to get into it, man. With that, let me cut on over to our discussion this week with Kevin from Brigade Watches. Here we go. Kevin, man, welcome to the Prepared Mindset. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you for having me. Super excited about talking to you, having a great conversation. So really appreciate your time as well.
Dude, I think so. I know a little bit about watches, and I know that they're a very popular segment or niche within our like the 2A. I don't even know. I hate calling it the 2A community. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even. And I even cringe calling it a community some days, the way people treat each other. But watches are something a lot of guys are real passionate about, or at least very interested in. In our space. So I'm happy to have you and your expertise on, because like I said, I know a little bit, but not, you know, like I know enough to embarrass myself is pretty much as far as I would go with that. So can you go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners and we'll jump in, man.
Yeah, of course. Kevin here. So founder, you can say CEO of the Brigade Watch Company. Prior to starting this company, I was a US Marine from 2011 to 2023. So just recently left the Marine Corps on the reserve side. And then I'm also a former banker and consultant. So I worked in mergers and acquisitions before starting the Brigade Watch Company. But
I work at a bank right
watches
now.
horology.
That's
Yeah,
funny.
what?
I work at a bank now. Yeah, it's
Oh, yeah.
yeah, funny how that happened.
So,
Yeah.
yeah, no, lived multiple different lives, but horology and watches have definitely been a passion since I was probably in middle school or high school, especially, I remember watching GoldenEye and James Bond wearing that Omega Seamaster, one of the first things I pinpointed in the movie. I just thought it was such a cool
That
topic.
is one of my abs that is my grail watch. Like, I know it's not the greatest, most expensive thing out there, but like, man, the bezel, the like the aesthetic behind the Seamaster, everything, it's just one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, no, amazing watch. I actually have, like, that was my first true real watch, mechanical movement, no batteries. I can say that it's also one of my luckiest watches because I lost it in a field training exercise once in the
Oh, shit.
woods. Someone found it, I don't know how, returned it to me. Then after I left active duty, was at a flag football game, lost it again somehow in the field, and somehow someone else found it again. So it's found its way back to me twice. So I call it my lucky ball.
Dude, yeah, especially anything that has that kind of like value tied to it too. Usually that stuff never walks its way back. That's it's gone. It's usually gone. That is lucky. Heck yeah, man. I would never get rid of that thing. So, you were in, you said from 11 to 23. what was the decision to like, so you leave active service. I'm gonna go start a watch company. Like, walk me through how you got from point A to point B on that with, I think you said with a banker, gig in between and stuff.
So it was not very planned. So at the end of my active service, I had two choices: continue or try to find a civilian career. And at the time, I actually met my now fiance, and we really wanted to settle down, start a life together. Her life was between California and New York. And at that point, I'm like, you know what? I'll take the sacrifice. Although I love being a Marine, I'm going to leave, and then I'm going to go try to figure out this civilian career thing. And I don't know why. I thought finance was the thing for me. And it could have been watching all the different like shows and t movies like Wall Street, people wearing suits. I'm like, that looks pretty cool. I kind of want to try whatever they're doing, right? But really was not planned. I couldn't tell you anything about banking or investments or wealth management like when I first started, but I got a really lucky opportunity at a consulting firm called KPMG, and I went through their veterans hiring initiative. So they gave me a shot at breaking into the industry, the consulting industry first, and I was aligned to banking and capital markets and financial services. So that's kind of how I got my start with my banking career. Did that for a while. So swap between consulting firms, banks such as Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and UBS, and then back into consulting firms like Deloitte again. But then unfortunately, 1.5 years ago, I actually lost my job due to the deal flow with mergers and acquisitions going down. So got laid off. And I could have jumped right back into finding a new opportunity, but my inspiration kind of came actually from my fiance. She looked me in the eye. She's like, "You've always said you if you were to do something fun and start a business, you would start a watch company because that's what you've been always talking about for like 10 years ever since you met." I'm like, "You're right." And she's like, "And what is the perfect option? You literally have nothing holding yourself back now. Like, there is no more excuse. Like, you have the time. Why don't you go ahead and do that?" And did some planning, swindled one of my best friends into the idea. It's one of those, "Hey,
Nice.
trust me, bro."
Yeah.
Somehow swindled my friend Josh. He's the other half of all of this into helping me out. And now we started this brand about 6, 7 months ago. And it looks like people are starting to be attracted to the brand now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe not 6 months ago, but it was a couple months ago. I found your guys' stuff on socials, and sharp looking watches. They follow that like dive aesthetic. I don't want to say the Submariner aesthetic, but I think they kind of like set that like North Star of design that everybody tries to, I'll say, emulate. Not necessarily copy, but emulate. And the rough part with that for people, I think, and you could probably share more on this than I can. People don't realize you can't just walk into a store and buy a Rolex Submariner. You can't, a lot of times, you can't walk into a store and buy a used one either.
No, you can't.
They're really, really exclusive, in addition to being prohibitively expensive in a lot of cases, right? So having an alternative to that is great, but then also having it being quality made at something that's at a price point that's relatively attainable for folks too, where you're not getting like, so you can, I mean, you can get on Amazon and find a $130 watch that looks just like, and I've thought about it. I was like, oh, it looks just like a Seamaster. Nobody would know until they got up close. And then I'm like, I would be throwing the money away. I'm not doing this, but having quality made watches and alternatives to some of those legacy brands, especially when you start to find out like the Seamaster, and not to say anything bad about Omega, there's a gentleman that runs the laser tag facility that we train CQB at, and we on week weeknights, and he has one. And I'm like, dude, that's amazing! Like, it's a watch I've always wanted one. He goes, yeah, I've had it 8 months and it's already been in to be serviced. I'm like, how? No, dude, you pay so much money for these. That's not supposed to be a thing. And it's like, okay, well, what am I paying for then? And people start to question it and stuff. So, not to throw shade at some of the bigger brands and everything, but having a quality made watch is important to folks for a lot of reasons. And having brands like what it looks like what you guys are trying to do, right, is important, I think, to the industry.
And I can kind of talk about why we started Brigade, and it's actually what you just hit upon. So I don't think a lot of people nowadays remember, but 15 years ago, you could walk into a Rolex boutique, take a look at all the watches they had on display, and actually walk out with a watch same day, right? You don't have to do the wait list, you don't have to pre-buy anything, and the experience was actually quite nice. Now, and at the time, you could get a Rolex Submariner for at retail and sometimes at a discount. And I think people forget about it. Rolex Submariners could be discounted back in the day for about five. You could probably get $5,000 to $6,000 for a Rolex Submariner date. That's no longer possible. And being someone who's really into watches, I was a really big Rolex supporter. But once you lose that AD relationship, whether or not the AD closed down or the salesperson or manager that you worked with moved on to another company, you kind of now have to start from the beginning. And one of the more recent times I walked into a Rolex boutique, it just felt like even as a longtime loyal customer, your money wasn't good enough for them, right? And you just had to play these different games, get put on wait lists, and you really can't leave with the watch that you saved up so much money for, right? And buying such an expensive watch should be a reward for hard work, what you've accomplished over the course of the year, celebrating, certain milestones in your life. And now when you walk into a Rolex boutique, despite all the hard work you put in, they're like, hey man, not good enough for
Not
us.
good enough. Yeah. Yeah. It's and it's so shitty. It's it got to be the worst feeling ever where you're like, what do you mean, dude? Like, I have money. What are you talking about?
But that's why it kind of motivated me, because just taking a look at some of their recent models, they're really great watches. I have to admit, like, Rolex knows what they're doing. But I've always loved their older models, the four-digit models especially, or the 16610. I love those timepieces. They're a little bit older, but I think they're the case shape, they're more well proportioned. However, when you hold an actual four-digit watch, I actually have a Rolex 5513 Submariner. When you hold it, it actually feels like it's about to fall apart. I don't think people nowadays realize that old four-digit Submariners are not heavy. They had the old, like, stamped bracelets. They feel light. But I don't think people realize that. So one of the things that we wanted to do was bring back some of those older designs, build them with more modern materials, ensure they're even more reliable than how they were originally designed. So we choose try to choose elaborate grade SW200s made by Sellita. We've tried to work with Sellita to ensure that these movements don't have the winding rotor issue. I know a lot of people have had those issues with SW200. But we do have an agreement with Sellita saying that if any of our watches default on the movement, we're just going to have a free replacement movement for you guys. So that's at the core of our businesses. We need to build solid, robust tool watches, and at the same time, kind of maintain that legacy factor, that inspiration that created the original four-digit subs. And one of the things we're leaning really strongly into is that military inspiration, because that's where the tool in the tool watch comes from. They were made for a certain purpose. And I understand nowadays we have digital watches, dive computers that are so much more accurate. But the fact that you can still take one of even our watches down diving and use the bezel and it works exactly how it was done back in the day, I think that's a very amazing thing.
Well, and you look at history and you read about Vietnam, or even, reading some of the books, like Jack Carr's books, which I love, and you read about like these old passed down like heirloom watches and stuff that were made, and they're still running, and guys want something like that. They want to own something like that. It's actually going to last, but then potentially, hey, I could pass this down to my son. Like there's a lure to that, versus like the I don't know, the $30 Walmart watch that you bought just because you needed something to tell time. And that's huge, I think, in our community, and why people are so attracted to spending more money on these. It's not just I mean, I guess for some people it might be like a flex, same reason you get some guys who are like, I just dropped, however many thousand dollars on night vision and I use it twice a year, and I love night vision, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, like, no, I'm buying this because I need it to last. I need it to be accurate and durable, and there's just not a guarantee in a lot of cases that, like, it may look good and it may have a brand name on it, but that is not in 2025 always indicative of quality. It's just not, unfortunately.
No, yeah. And it really depends. And obviously, I don't want to bash other brands. I don't want any names, but you can actually, I think the consumer and the end customer is they're very smart. They see when manufacturers start cutting corners and cutting costs, especially if they've been a previous customer or a legacy customer. And I think some of the big names out there, some are keeping the quality high. Others are now decreasing the quality. And just now being in the business, when we see a watch, we can immediately tell, oh, they cut 50 cents off here, a dollar off here, right? Do they affect the overall function of the watch? No, not necessarily. But sometimes it comes down to finishing of the movement, finishing of the case back, finishing of the bracelets, right? And when you start simplifying that, yes, you do end up saving a lot more money per watch, but functionally, it is probably the same. But when they were held to a higher standard, or they were making watches at a higher caliber, that's what they were known for. And it's just one of the sad things that I've seen, at least over the last 10, 15 years, where, you know, what you expected in the past is not necessarily something that's happening now.
Yeah, and that's what people are buying. That's what they're buying. They're, I'm sorry, they're that's the expectation they're buying, is that it's going to be that idea of 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, 40 years ago, depending on the brand, where, hey, I grew up seeing these. I knew they're a great brand, you know. Grandpa always wore one, and then you buy yours and you're like, brand new, whatever. And it could be any brand, you know. I'm not picking on anybody specifically, but and then it falls apart. And in some instances, if you're actually using these in the manner which they were designed, right? That there's you know, consequences to that. I mean, you know, I never served in the military, but I do know that having a reliable watch is something that in a lot of instances you're required to have for a number of reasons.
Oh,
So,
yes.
you know, a reliable movement is a huge part of it, or guys will cheap out and sometimes they'll go with like the quartz movements. Batteries just die because people don't. And I'm super guilty of that. I used to go to work all the time and look at my watch. God damn it, it's dead again. Like, you know, whatever. And I would just switch out with another watch. Now I have like seven upstairs that need new batteries, because right now I wear a Glycine Combat sub.
Oh,
And
that's a great piece. Yeah.
I like the history behind the company, and I found it on closeout at Costco. So I was like, I'm taking that home. But like, you know, you just let those watches die, and that's why the automatic movement's better. And in my opinion, on some instances and stuff, and like, it's just, you need to ha it, there's the reliability can't be overstated. It's super important for so many reasons when you're in the field, and then even just like in general, like, who wants to deal with that? Like, who's got the time to run to a store and go, hey, can you swap my battery out for me? Oh, okay, cool. $35. Wow. All right. Okay, here we go. And that kind of thing. So yeah, having the movements and all that stuff be, and I would think they would have gotten better with time too, but it seems like a lot of the ones people go back to, they actually do have some substantial issues losing time, and you have to adjust them every couple of days. Is that pretty common, or is that something that you only see with cheaper watches? Like, I honestly, I'm asking because I don't know.
So I think it really depends on it is movement dependent, right? So I'm never going to argue that a mechanical movement is as accurate as a quartz. Let's be honest, just clear the air. Quartz movements from an accuracy standpoint in general will be more accurate than an automatic movement. So that's number one. Number two is when watchmakers build watches, and it happens with us too, right? But we have processes in place to kind of correct for it. The movement is generally brand new when it's encased into a watch. Now, how do you kind of figure out the wear out period? Because sometimes the movement needs to wear in over the course of 1 week, 2 weeks, sometimes up to a month. Now, some movements are better than others in wearing in and maintaining that standard. And then to your point, some watches lose time or gain time. And it all comes down to that regulation factor and wear in period. Because again, when a new movement is brand new, and this is where the engineering, not watchmaking, comes in. And I think people always mix up engineering versus watchmaking. The gears are very tight, right? And as they start moving around, they're going to start loosening. And also, another factor is lubrication. What type of lubrication are you using on your movement, right? Because there's a movement, the ST36, which is based off of the ETA 6497. It's essentially a Chinese clone of the ETA 6497. And if you read online, everyone's saying that the ST36 is extremely unreliable. It breaks down all the time. There's this issue, that mechanical issue, you know, like it's just not a reliable movement. But when you kind of peel back the onion a little bit, and this is where I think a lot of misinformation comes, it's, well, most of these manufacturers aren't even lubricating the movement before putting them in watches. And if you get the actual manual from Seagull Factory, it actually states that the movements are shipped without lubrication, and they highly recommend that you lubricate them prior to assembling them into watches, right? So I
Wait,
know that's a very extreme case.
we pack firearms in grease and stuff for, and why would you not include any kind of lubricant? I don't, all right.
Yeah, I'm not
Okay.
sure why they ship without lubrication, but that is the cause of so many mechanical watch failures. So, before we started Brigade, I was tinkering around with this and I came across the same common misconception. And then I'm like, well, there's a manual here that says it needs to be lubricated. Well, let's give that a try. Right? And lo and behold,
Yeah.
it's still running.
Following the instructions. What a novel concept. Yeah. Yeah, that is
So,
wild, although not entirely
yeah.
surprising, to be honest.
Right. But again, like it really depends, right? And it's really hard for you to actually find that break-even point where, hey, I need to accommodate the break-in period of the movement, the perfect amount of lubrication, and then sending it out to the customer. Like, how long are we actually testing this watch? Because if we're testing this watch for like four weeks, the customer's just gonna start getting angry at us, right? Like they ordered it like a month ago. So, and it really is a watchmaking and engineering issue, I think, because I think common misconception is like watchmakers understand everything about the movement and everything. But when it comes to engineering the case, the engineering behind the movement, it's a completely different ball game there.
So it's so they most of these makers or are they truly makers, or are they just a, like buying a movement and assembling parts that they're buying from other companies? Because some of these actually, they're relatively affordable for what you get. But then,
Yes.
I mean, like you said, consumers are smart, right?
Yeah,
It
they're
starts
smart.
to raise alarms, and you're like, okay, wait a minute. You're telling me in your product description that this is the same, I don't know, same steel as this other company
Yeah.
and the same movement as I saw in this other company. So like, how are you doing it for $200 less? Like, what am
Yes.
I? What are you not telling me?
Right.
And then you start to kind of figure out, and it, I'm asking, but like some companies are really just buying the casing from one company, the bracelet from another, the movement from a third,
Yeah.
and then they just assemble it and resell it. They white label it and throw their logo on it.
Yeah. So to answer the question, yes. I think different companies run different types of business models from, to your point, buying generic cases, generic movements, and then assembling them in a certain facility. Then you kind of have like a hybrid where people are actually designing brand new cases. They're manufacturing it here. However, they don't have the capabilities to create their own in-house movement. So they're relying on companies like La Joupurée or Sellita to provide them that third-party movement. And obviously, what we call in-house, like the big guys, right? They have the ability to create and actually machine out the parts for the movement, build the actual movement, assemble that movement, test it out prior to putting them into the cases. And I can only speak for Brigade. I only know our operations. I'm not too clear about other companies, obviously, although I have talked to other executives and trying to interview, but I obviously can't speak for them. But in general, so Brigade, when we say we design everything here in the United States, so we design the case, the bracelet set, we'll design the dial, we'll design the hands, and we try our best to source all the parts here in the United States. Now, when it comes down to the movement, I understand that I think there's like American-made movements now too. However, we wanted to select a movement that had a legacy of reliability that kind of a lot of other companies use, right? And another thing is parts. So what happens if this watch breaks down because it's mechanical. Anything mechanical will break down over time. Now, let's say 30 years from now, if you needed a part for an SW200, I can guarantee you can find that. For some of these newer manufacturers, new movement makers, that's a big question that makes me uncomfortable. I'm not saying they won't be around, but I know that I can source SW200 slash ETA 2824 parts very, very easily. And we can quickly get a watch up and running because there are a plethora of parts out there that we can use. Now, going to answer your other part of the question, like what's the difference between a company that just assembles everything, some companies that design the cases but get a third party movement? Yeah, there are both types of those companies. And I think micro brands are kind of stuck because it's all about resources at the end of the day. It's all about financials. It's not profit. Like, and I can tell you, our company, we have not broken profit yet, right? And it's very hard because if you're trying to maintain a certain standard, like cutting the cost from R&D, cutting the cost on materials, your customers are going to notice immediately. And trust me, I walk into meetings every single week where people are like, hey, we're about to, we have a few projects down the line and we're trying to come up with a pricing plan. And I try to push the price down as much as possible. And then our finance guy's looking at me, it's like, we're not going to break profit on this. And then I'm like, yeah, but the customer is going to notice, right? And we're very for designing our own cases, making our own reinvented design of the four-digit Submariner right now. But other companies where they can kind of gain that extra margin is, yes, they can wholesale buy a whole bunch of generic cases, generic dials, generic hands. Those are going to be a lot cheaper for them to buy in bulk, right? And I'm not saying those are bad watches. They're actually probably really good watches because they're used by several different companies, and to your point
Sure.
before, they're all white labeled, right? So you know, all you have to do is find a wholesaler. You don't even have to go to the end manufacturer. You're going to be able to find a pile of these things and put them together, and you're going to be able to get that margin. And they're probably going to be very robust watches, right? I have big respect for the Miyota 9 series movements and the Seiko or NH series movements. Very robust movements. And you really can't say anything bad about them, but you know, they definitely, a lot of manufacturers are moving toward that direction, mainly because, yeah, it's cost effective. What we're doing is more of my personal mission to build, to kind of elevate that bar a little bit, right? And
Yeah,
to ensure that's,
that's
yeah.
incredible, man. Like, just, well, I mean, because you see it so often now, where people are like, well, we'll improve upon it in generation three or four, like the iterative improvement, like we'll get it up and running. And I mean, I get that too, but it's kind of awesome to hear that there's a company doing it. Like, hey, we're going to start by making a really good product, and we're not going to sacrifice on that. I think that's awesome. You don't see it anymore.
No, and it is tough, it is difficult, and we get questions and emails all the time like, hey, why can't you guys do this? Why can't you guys do that? And at the same time, the answer is very clear. It's we don't have enough money to do the things that we actually want to do. What we can guarantee is our watches are produced to a certain high standard that I would take into the field, that I would give to my colleagues in the military to take into the field and have it be extremely reliable, right? We even get questions that are like, because the SW200 has that rotor issue, people are like, well, why are you using it? And really, if you think about all the other Swiss manufacturers that are out there, Sellita's probably the biggest one that can deliver a high quality movement at a good price point. And we're so small, we don't get the good pricing that Glycine can get, right? They're buying like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of movements. Our orders are like, hey, we'd like 100 to 150, please, right? So we're paying basically close to retail. And when I see people on Reddit and all these message forums like, oh, Glycine can do it for this, why can't Breguet do it? And I'm like, well, yeah, it's probably because they pay half of what we pay for
Yeah,
it.
it's and I just actually had somebody say that to me about totally, well, totally different section of industry, the IR lasers. They're like, yeah, this company can do it super cheap. We can't scale. Scale is the hardest nut to crack, because if you can achieve scale, that means you can achieve volume, which means you get those discount prices from your suppliers and everything. And it's like, but if it were that easy, everybody would do it with everything. And it just isn't. There's a lot that goes into getting to that point in any business,
Exactly.
and I think, I think that's something that, well, I mean, it is Reddit, so people that don't want to understand business, they're just going to have their opinion. And people that have dabbled, right? Or at least just bother to reach out and go, hey man, what is the explanation? I think you're being very transparent here. I think you'd probably tell anybody like, well, we're doing what we can. That's the simplest answer. Like, but people don't, they don't give a shit. It's Reddit. They're in their mom's basement and they're, doing what they do. But I mean, yeah, it's a reliable it's a reliable movement. Like, and like you said, anything mechanical is going to have that threshold where it's going to, it's going to have issues. I mean, up till 10 years ago, everybody would have said that SIG handguns were super reliable and would never have an issue until they all of a sudden did, and even, like anything else, Glocks, you have, Glock handguns, they occasionally do have quality control problems. Like, it does happen, guys, So I'm a big believer in, like, give the company some grace, and if the customer service takes care of it, then, like, yeah, the headache is the headache, but, like, I'm good with it. Anybody should be. Just be reasonable. Like, nothing's ever 100 for 100 in business. It just isn't.
No, I really appreciate your sentiment because we've been trying to tighten up our quality control processes since we began 7 months ago. I would love to sit here and say, hey, we've been perfect batting 100%, but we do have quality control issues sometimes. And one of the things I keep telling our guys is like, no matter how hard we try, I think we're going to have one or two that slip the quality control line. And again, it's down to the resources, right? Who, like, we have our watchmakers double checking the finished watch every single time one is produced. Then we have a second individual, another watchmaker who independently verifies that, right? But occasionally, even under intense light and everything, we might miss like a small speck next to like an hour marker, right? That's one of the things that we've been trying to pick up a lot on. But what I do guarantee is that, hey, if a customer gets their watch, something's wrong with it, Brigade will always take care of you. Like, we'll replace parts, we'll give you a brand new watch, but we'll always make sure that you are taken care of and you're going to end up with that high quality piece. Like, just give us a little bit of grace period, but we'll make it right with you every single time.
Yeah, no, that's the way it should be. I mean, it's how business used to be done. I think we're seeing a lot of companies get back to it, thankfully, right? But yeah, you invest in your customer base, they will invest in you, especially as you continue to grow. And talking about growth, so you guys have two models out right now,
Two
and
models.
one of them is your dive watch. The name, I'm sorry, it is eluding me, but I know one is like a, for people listening, it's like a normal watch, and the other one looks like a Rolex, sort of, like, in simplest terms. How did you, so when looking at, like, the drawing board and going, obviously you explained already you like some of the four digit Rolexes, and that was like a big source of inspiration. But some of the decisions that can be made around, like, GMT and bezels, and I've seen you guys post a lot about the bezel material and stuff, because those will, depending on material, crack, break, fade, chip, whatever. How did you make some of those decisions on which routes to go with that? Because there's tons of options out there to pursue, right? That could be, I think, following that military style lineage that you spoke of, right? In a number of ways. How did you figure out what was the right path forward for your next step?
So I'll talk about our sub-commander model first. That's the dive watch. That one is very near and dear to my heart, because that particular model, the inspiration came from a lot of my colleagues who are into watches, military folks, Marines specifically. And Rolex Submariners are now what, $10,000, sometimes $11,000. You're not taking that into the field. And time again, I'm gonna shout out to one of my friends, JD. He would like, I would love to have a Rolex Submariner that I can actually take into the field and scrape up, and then he always said that to me, and then that sentiment kind of echoed through my network, my friends' networks as well. And I'm like, well, if everyone wants this watch and no one's making it, well, I'm just gonna go make it, right? It seemed like people actually want this thing to come out. And again, the Submariner's an icon, right? We're not trying to imitate the Submariner. We're trying to kind of recreate what made the Submariner great in the first place. That four-digit sub that has the military bezel, that has great luminosity underneath water. And we're trying to modernize it, right? Again, the four-digit sub, if you hold one, it feels like it's about to fall apart. So some of the things that we took a look at is the original four-digit subs came with an acrylic crystal. And for those who may not know, the military used acrylic crystals for a single factor because it will not shatter. It will break, but it will not shatter into a million different glass shards and pieces that may interfere with other equipment or things that you're using on your mission. So that's the reason they had an acrylic crystal. Now, bringing it forward to today, we have sapphire crystals, which were not commonplace in the 1960s and 70s, right? So that particular piece, we're like, hey, we want to make it anti-scratch. So let's just pick the hardest crystal we can find and let's make it domed because the structure, and I have my sub-commander here, is once it's domed, it creates, again, now not going out of watchmaking, but going into engineering, that domed structure is a little bit stronger than a flat crystal, right? It does take. It is actually more expensive to create a double dome sapphire crystal than a flat crystal. And I'm sure people who understand economics know it's flat, you can utilize that piece and that material more efficiently. Dome, you have to literally cut each domed shape
There's
out
more
so you
waste
can use more
per,
material. Correct.
yeah.
But because of the shape, it's a little bit more robust, it's a little bit more impact resistant. So that's why we chose that dome on it. Now for the bezel action, this is the part where I think it's a little bit more controversial because everyone has a different opinion on it. We did not go with ceramic, and this is because of a personal experience with dumbass Second Lieutenant Kevin Ding back in the day, who decided to wear his Rolex Submariner on a field exercise. So I forgot what happened, but we were doing this was back, I think I was at the basic school, but you know, we're doing urban training and we're jumping in and out of buildings, going in and out of windows. And of course, you know, you should really never wear a Rolex to these things. You're just gonna get it destroyed. And obviously I smashed my watch against the concrete floor because I flipped over a window, fell right on my face, and obviously watch went like that. And of course, the first thing you think about is like, oh no, I'm hurt. Like, no, I'm like, oh my God, my watch. Right.
Yeah, like, oh, screw my arm and my knee, but is the watch okay?
Yeah. Take my watch. Bezel completely scratched, dented a little bit. However, it was one of the older Rolexes, but the bezel did not break. It was scratched, but the bezel was still usable. And yeah, it hurt my heart greatly, but that was one of the things I remember. Like, this aluminum bezel did not fail. Fast forward a few years, I had another friend with a modern Rolex Submariner. We're doing field exercises again, and we're doing this rappel thing off of a hill or a mountain. And you know, this is when you know we're getting first lieutenant captain pay. So we got a little bit more money. So he got his Rolex Submariner and literally rappelled wrong and hit the side of the mountain. Comes down, the entire ceramic bezel is broken. That at the time was a $600 repair for him. So those two
That's
experiences
painful.
led up to when we designed the bezel. Trust me, our team was like, Kevin, you need to do a ceramic bezel. It's what's modern. It's what the people want. I'm like, not when you're in these tactical situations. That thing will shatter on you. And I guarantee you, and I told them these anecdotal stories. I'm like, just trust me, it will happen. Someone is going to get a major impact on the bezel. And 6 months down the line, we had several customers reach out to us for bezel replacements because they did not break, but they dented, right? So we're happy to say that we haven't had a single bezel actually break on us.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff where, like, you know, you made the right choice for the same for those reasons, exactly like you said, because people are out there using these, right? They're being built as not as you know, and it's nothing against fashion watches. I know that they have like a bad name in the watch community because they're usually very nice to look at, sometimes a little bit, you know, over the top and gaudy, but they throw, you know, whatever designer. That's it. And honestly, I got away from that stuff very early on, thankfully. But I'm trying to, like, it eludes me right now. But any like name brand clothing designer, right? Like Ralph Lauren, and it's like, oh yeah, my mom got me a Ralph Lauren watch when I got my first job in banking because I needed a watch, and I was like, oh okay, cool. And within 6 months, I had hour markers like falling off, and now they're just like rattling around inside the watch like a snow globe. And I'm like, this is stupid. And you know, I have the heart to go to my mom and be like, what the hell? She doesn't know any better. So I'm like, all right, I went and bought like a $125 Citizen, like quartz.
Yeah.
Great watch. I've had zero issues with it.
Yeah.
And I think when she found out how much I spent, she goes, "You spent that much on a watch?" I'm like, "Yeah, I what? Let me have, at the time I think I said, let me have nice things." And it's now I'm like, it's not a bad watch. It's certainly not like a nice watch, but it still runs, still no issues, no problems and everything.
Yeah.
You want to be able to wear this stuff, and especially in our community, when guys, even on the civilian side, you're going out, you're taking
Right.
weekend training classes, you're shooting, you're doing, structure clearance courses. Guys, I have friends that have taken breaching classes where they're running saws and hammers and cutting torches. Like, you don't want to have to worry about, oh wait, everybody stop, let me take my watch off. Like, no, you that's your watch. I think there's, I don't know, I've kind of gotten to the point where I really enjoy that I have like my watch. I wear it every day. It's not like a rotating piece of jewelry or anything. And I think a lot of guys want that. And if you can't depend on that to live up to the lifestyle that you're leading, it's not the watch for you.
It's not the one, right? Yeah. No, and to your point, I think everyone has different occupations, right? If you're mostly an office job, like you're not going to be in the same situations as military and law enforcement. So I think it's all about point of view. It's very hard for you to put yourself in the shoes of a military and law enforcement person. And I'm glad you kind of stated that the indices fell off of your Ralph Lauren watch, right? That's actually happened to me too. But when we tell customers that's why we went for a painted dial, people are like, no, you guys are just cheapening out. I'm like, no, it's because those things will fall off the second you hit like a hard wall. Like, I promise you. But again, it's about point of view. And that military law enforcement individual, they're not gonna know what it feels like to be that office worker, right? Office workers, they want to pair watches up with the suit, the ties, right? They have different purposes for this watch, right?
Right,
I'm
100%.
not saying it's wrong or less, but different purposes, right? They need it to be functional yet stylish. Whereas military guys prefer function over style. They just need it to work at the end of the day. And that's the community that we're trying to embrace and trying to support. Because again, the reason Brigade started was a lot of people have asked us, we just want, the Omegas, the Rolexes, but we want to be able to wear into the field, scratch them up, and not, pay like a $1,000 servicing fee to get it fixed up again. It's just one of the things we're trying to embrace to make sure our watches are robust as possible, things don't fail on them, and you won't be afraid to scratch them up. That's what they're used for. They're supposed to be submerged, they're supposed to go into mud, they're supposed to be scratched, they're supposed to be banged up into walls, right? Like, do your worst. That's what Brigade is about.
And that I think it falls in, I think you said it, tool watch, right? That's what everyone looks for, I think, or at least most people I talk to. They may own other watches, right? For like you're saying, when they have to match it with a suit or go to an occasion, but your everyday, it's so when for people who don't understand, and I have my own definition of a tool watch, but if you were to have to explain to somebody, what is a tool watch? Why should you have a tool watch? Is it purely just the materials it's being made out of? Because I think a lot of people assume it's always stainless steel, and I think there's some other options in there. But if you had to explain it to somebody, how would you explain it?
I think it's two different things. It's number one, a tool watch needs to be functional in some way. Again, it's a tool for you to accomplish your mission. Like for the Submariner, it's that rotating bezel to make sure that you have enough oxygen in your tank so that you can come back up. For our Hurricane models, the reason why the numbers are so big is because in the dark, you should be able to see what time it is. And I understand now there's modern instruments. We're no longer flying in like World War II, right, with analog instruments. But if everything fries out with like potentially an EMP, you want to know that, hey, I can actually mark time with my flight watch. The hands are big. I just need a glance at it and I'll be able to use this as a tool. So function is the first definition. Number two is the materials, right? What materials support that functionality? And most of the time, we do choose stainless steel because it is a very robust material. We choose 316L because it has that property of being very hard, semi scratch resistant, but you're still going to scratch it. But the biggest thing is If you submerge it in seawater, it's not going to rust. It's very resistant to corrosion, right? It's not as corrosive resistant as 916. I think it's 90. Sorry, I always mix up the numbers, but 904L, the one that Rolex, like all these different. It's not as corrosive resistant. I believe 904L has more nickel content. And again, going to the engineering of things, at least our engineers tell us it's actually a softer metal because of the nickel content. But it is also more expensive. It's harder to mill. It's harder to mold into a watch case. So that's why most manufacturers use 316. It's slightly easier, slightly cheaper to use. But that material needs to support the overall functionality. There's other materials that can be used, like the rubbers, the plastics, right? Now we have carbon. So all these can now be made into very robust feel watches. One of the best watches I ever had, when I first got into the system, the pipeline for the military was a Casio. It wasn't a G-Shock, but it was like a Casio digital watch. That thing could take a beating like crazy,
You
right?
see those stories on those things all the time. People are like, hey, I bought this Garmin watch and it died after 6 months or whatever. And hey, I got this Casio. It was $55 and it's 10 years old and it's still going. You're like, can't explain it, but they last forever. You know, they're built pretty well, honestly.
No, they are real. Like my Casio cost me probably $30. And to your earlier comment, I got it at Walmart before I went to OCS. And the other day I was just like playing around with it. It still works. Yeah, all the paint is gone now. You can't read the words. Hey, but the movement inside, it's still working. I had to replace the battery a couple times, but solidly built watch, right?
That's
So when it
actually
comes,
when people come to me and they get sticker shock on like real watches or good watches. I'm like, go get a Casio Duro. They're like, but it's only $50. I'm like, but it looks like what you're looking for. And while you're saving up for that good watch, this thing isn't going to be an issue. Like, I would be very shocked if you had problems with this. Everybody knows it's a good, reliable watch. Yes, it's only $50. Is the prettiest thing. Yeah, I don't really love the hands on it personally. They got some cool options. You can get a Pepsi one. I was like, okay, I should grab one of those just for the fun of it, but it's there. Then you can save your money for however long it takes you to go get whatever you really want. Yeah, they're great, I think.
No, they're great. And I'm not opposed to like cheaper watches and all that stuff. I think in the sub $500 range, there's a lot of great choices. My fiance now makes fun of me all the time. I probably have a collection of about like 50 watches, literally ranging from $10 watches to like some of the Rolexes. But I do wear the sub $500 watches like a lot more, just because nowadays, like, you're afraid of getting your Rolex or Omega scratched, right? But where I'm wearing like a sub $500 watch, you're like, ah, yes, I can do whatever I want. I can go snowboarding in this thing. Like,
With it, right.
yeah. So, but definitely not of it. There's really a lot of good choices. But what it comes down to, I think, when companies are creating like price points and stuff like that, it's the materials, it's how it's being built, where it's being built. There's things that you can do when you're designing your watch to make it slightly cheaper from a production standpoint, right? Again, like one of the easiest things is flat crystal versus double dome. Like you're gonna save something like $30, $40 of production cost just from there per piece if you go with a flat crystal, right? And it's surprising now because like now I didn't know this about a year and a half ago, right? And I always thought it was design elements, but now that we're putting together our own watches, designing it on our own computer-aided design, and I'm like, I want that. And then the engineer's looking at me, he's like, dude, that doubles our cost. And I'm like, oh.
Oh, yeah, darn it. Yeah. And that's the stuff people don't see and they don't realize. You know, they just want it. But one of the things you had mentioned was the like on dive watches, right? Using the bezel is actually has an intent, right, around air and understanding when you need to come back up. And so with that in mind, when people are looking at some of these watches, I think sometimes they just go off the aesthetic, but there's differences, right? Like, and I don't honestly know. I know GMT is one. I just know it's the one that has more numbers on it, looks more crowded. I don't like it. And then you have, I don't know what the other one is. It's like just got your 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and everyone knows your bezels click and rotate, but they don't understand, you know, why and how that works. Can you talk a little bit about that for folks?
So I'll go with our strike commander. It's a 60-minute tick mark. And the bezel only turns in one direction. It's called unidirectional. Now, the original actually was a bidirectional bezel, so it could go left or right. And a lot of people don't know that the original MILSA did that. Now, the reason it should be unidirectional is when you put the hour marker on the minute, right? And let's say you're diving and it accidentally hits the bezel and the bezel moves, right? The bezel will always tell you have less time underwater than more time. So with a bidirectional bezel, if it goes the other way, you're like, oh, I'm good, I got another hour down here.
Yeah, but you
Right?
don't.
But you don't, right? So that's the safety that's built into the bezel, right? When it's unidirectional, it'll always tell you have less time than you have. So when it comes to GMT, that thing is to mark a different time zone, right? So you have the GMT hand and then you have the GMT bezel. And theoretically, you can actually have three different time zones on a GMT watch, depending on how it's designed. And I'm obviously referencing like the Rolex GMT. That's the most common one or most popular one. You can theoretically track three different things. And then I know Rolex uses a true GMT hand so that the hour hand moves independently. And I know this is a controversial statement, but I have a true GMT and I have office GMTs. And when I talk to other watch people or other people I used to work with, and I'm like, why is a true GMT hand better? They can never tell me, right? And then I'm just like, personally, I think it's easier to move the GMT hand than moving the hour hand, like rotating several
All the way
ways
around,
around, right? So I'm like, personally, but everyone always wants that true GMT, but I have a feeling a lot of people don't know what true GMT
yeah,
is.
it's probably one of those like culture snobs where it's like, oh, you just don't do, it's just not done, so we can't have that. And it's like, but could you tell me why? And they never can, and that's fine. Like, it's America, like, party on, man. But it is kind of funny when you're like, you can't tell me why. Okay, whatever. Yeah, I don't. I mean, like I said, everybody have their own opinion. I just find it funny when guys are very insistent on stuff like that and they can't articulate it.
So I think to your point, when it comes to tool watches, the original designers who created these ideas and implemented them onto the old vintage style tool watches, they were really good ideas, but I think that's been lost over time. And I think one of the clear things is the Rolex Explorer 2's bezel, right? I don't know if people noticed, but when you look at the Rolex Explorer 2 bezel, all the numbers are actually upright. So if you look at other watch bezels, the numbers at the 6 o'clock are upside down. The Rolex Explorer 2 is one of the only bezels that have all the numbers in the cur in the same direction. And it was actually made for cave divers, so that when they quickly looked at their watch, they wouldn't actually get confused. They would know, like, there's an entire guide behind it, and I can't really at this moment remember how it actually used, but there's a reason why those numbers are upright and not upside down, like on my watch right now, where the 30 is, sorry, you can't see, but where the 30 is upside down.
Yeah, it's upside down.
So there's a good reason for it. So when I see other people trying to emulate, I'll use the word emulate, their Explorer 2, and they have the numbers upside down, I'm like, oh man, you guys did not do your research.
Yeah, it's like a key characteristic of the watch, and you skip over it. Maybe just be, well, I don't know. And maybe I'm just negative. My first thought is like, oh, you bulk order your bezels from a manufacturer, and they weren't willing to do it for the same price, or you couldn't get it, or something. So you're just like, well, it'll
Exactly.
look close. Most people won't catch it. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just being negative, though.
No, I think that's right. It's because we understand where a lot of these parts are sourced, and it's no secret. If you run a watch company, a lot of these places, you know exactly who's supplying it, who the main manufacturer is. A lot of these companies are in China, Hong Kong, Singapore is actually becoming big, Malaysia is another place. But yeah, to your point, it's because you can bulk buy the bezels, you can bulk buy the cases, right? And if they stamped it one way, for you to change it to the correct way, it's going to cost you probably double to have a customized version of that same thing.
Yeah, and that's yeah, obviously then that cuts into your profit margin, and that just isn't just isn't acceptable. And in your experience with some of these, I know you guys are trying to make a better watch. You're trying to not cut those corners, you're trying to not do those things. How reliable are, like, for people who are looking, and because everyone's always right, like, oh, it's just as good, or and I both love and hate that argument, because inevitably you get those people that have the one that didn't fall apart, and they're like, it's fantastic, and you're like, well, is it, or did you get lucky? How are a lot of those watches, like, it feels like when you buy a watch, because when you look at we look at the internals, right, of any watch, gears and springs and the master craftsmanship, even, it doesn't have to be Rolex. Like, we've talked a lot about Rolex, but any of these things, when you look at what goes into it, you're talking about something very complex. So to get something for very cheap to no money, I'm skeptical. But how, I mean, for people that are listening, how can they trust that that's going to really do the job for them? I mean, it's kind of
If
a
you could
tough
clarify,
net. Yeah.
if you could clarify that question, because are you asking, with some manufacturers, they're using cheaper components, are they getting away with it? Was that the question?
Yeah, like when people go and they buy that sub $200 watch, right? And it's going to be fine. Is it really, like, where do people, where do the, I guess what I'm wondering is, where do people see the breakdowns happen? Where are people really going to, from a customer's experience side of things, or an end user, I should say, experience side of it, where are you going to notice the breakdowns and the, those rough edges, so to speak, in the final product?
You're gonna find, so if you're pushing down the list price of a watch, let's say to the sub $200 range, manufacturers have to cut corners to make that price point, right? So they're not going to use the 316L or 904L stainless steels. They're going to use cheaper quality steels, or maybe not even stainless steel, right? I remember one of my very first watches. It was an Armatron. It was, I forgot what the material was, but it definitely wasn't stainless steel. But that one, I think, I mean, this is dating me, but this was when I was in high school in the 2000s. That was about probably a 30, 40 watt dollar watch at that time. And you could tell that, although the watch was heavy, it was probably, I want to say it was probably brass of some sort, because like once the stainless steel surface kind of came off, you could see kind of like the gold and whatever
Oh, yeah.
plating like underneath it. So that's kind of where they're sometimes cutting corners. When it comes down to dial and hands, though, I'll be honest, I really, at least from my limited experience, I don't see a big price change when it comes to dial and hands, because those components are so small. And if you're mass producing them, you basically can achieve them very easily. Now, the only difference is what type of lube you're using on those hands and dials. That is going to be the key differentiator in the price of the dial. It's going to either be a $3 dial if you're using cheaper lube, or it could be up to $15, $20, $25 for Swiss Super Luminova, right? Glowing blue, right? That's the new trend that's going on. So that's going to be a little bit more expensive. It comes down to like a material type issue. Now, does that compromise functionality? Yes and no, right? Because again, going back to that old Armatron, it used a Japanese quartz movement. That Japanese quartz movement probably will never break on you. Super robust. The entire case will fall apart, but the thing will still keep telling time, right? Now there are newer movements from newer manufacturers that are extremely cheap. Time will tell if those things are reliable. But in general, if you're starting to take a look at, the $10 price range, you think about it, like with case, dial, quartz. I've only seen one $10 watch recently, but factor in, them needing to sending it to a distributor and the distributor's taking their cut. Like, how much money was actually invested in that $10 watch to make it good, right?
Yeah, not much. I mean, like,
Like probably not that much, right? So It's really difficult. But at the same time, I know if you bought a lot of the parts on like Alibaba or AliExpress, you could probably make yourself a very nice NH series movement watch for $100. Yeah, you know, maybe less if you shop the sales. You can get the movement for $25. I think that was the cheapest I ever got mine. Maybe $20, right? If you know how to negotiate with people. But let's call it $25. The case is another $20, $30 if you get it on sale, and it usually comes with a bracelet set. You get your dial for another $10 and hands for another like $5, and you basically have like your entire watch together, right? Now, will that thing break on you? Probably not. The NH series movements are really, really robust, right? But you can accomplish that for less than $100 easily.
And that's wild to think that you can. Most people don't have the, like, I wouldn't try and build one. Like, I mean, and I know there's websites out there. They run their whole business on, you can build this yourself. I'm like, yeah, but why would I want to? Like, I don't trust myself to do that. Like, no, thank you, sir. I'll pay somebody to assemble for me. And for people who are looking for that, cool. Not me. I won't even try and change my own batteries. I'm just like worried about it. Just being completely transparent, I'll own it. People go, it's so easy. I'm just, I don't trust myself with that. I want my watches to stay in good shape. And I don't even know how much is exposed when you take the battery, out. It could be nothing, and I could be sounding like a total moron right now, but I've never found out because it's just not on my list of stuff to do. That's that you take it to a jeweler, have them take care of it. And honestly, while you're there, have it serviced, or if it's an automatic, have it serviced regularly anyways. And I'll ask you, how often should people be servicing their watches? And does that change depending on, like, if I bought your guys' Subcommander, this is like the glycine that I'm running right now. Is there like, oh, hey, every 6 months you should have it serviced with any watch as a rule of thumb, or does it really depend on movement or anything like that?
So I don't think it's movement dependent. So I'm about to ruin everyone's businesses out there, but my recommendation is you do not need to get it serviced until the movement starts failing on you. And when the mechanical movement is about to fail, you're gonna have indicators. You're gonna start losing, gaining time. It may even start skipping some beats. The second hand may not start immediately once you wind it. There's gonna be signs before it fully breaks down. That's the point where you should actually get it serviced because if it's operating perfectly well, even 5, 10 years, like these mechanical movements, they can go 10 years without having major issues, right? But let's say like it's 10 years, it's still working properly. Like why are you getting it serviced? Because if you're using a very common movement, changing out that part every 5 years and every 10 years, that part's going to cost the same amount of money. It's one of those things. And people will say you need to do preventative maintenance. I'm like, well, just knowing the SW200, well, if the part really does fail, we're just going to change it out with a new part at the end of the day. And that's really when, and it's not going to cost you anything extra if you serviced it like 5 years earlier, right? In fact, you're paying more money if you service it every 5 years, when manufacturers generally tell you to service it, but my recommendation, don't service it until it actually starts showing signs of wear breaking down. And these mechanical movements will last you like a decade. If they're really good movements and really good watches, like they will last you a decade before it needs its first service. It really will.
That makes me so happy because I'm so bad about doing that.
Like my Omega from like my Omega runs the old caliber 1120, which is based on the ETA 2824. That thing hasn't been serviced in 11 years now, and I literally just took it on vacation with me to France the other last month, and still working fine.
No issues.
No issues with that one. And I have some older Rolexes, my old four-digit Rolex. I don't know when the last time that thing was serviced. I actually got it secondhand. Hey, it's only 5 seconds slow a day. I'm okay with that. You know, it probably does need a service, but hey, I can count. So 5 second slow day, it's still technically within COSC standards, so, or barely there, but it still works. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't over 5 seconds a day, I wouldn't make a big deal about it. If it got worse, obviously then maybe you make a different decision, but like that wouldn't bother me at all. I mean, I don't know if that makes me lazy or what. I don't care, but 5 seconds a day is not enough for me to do that. It just isn't.
Yeah, and I try to tell our customers that because we get that question all the time. Oh, should I send it back for, warranty repair or servicing? And I like we're every time we send out an email, we're perfectly honest. Like, really, just send it back when it starts like failing. And but it will take years and possibly up to a decade before you see any like major issues with it. It really, unless you want us to polish the case, make it look nice on the outside, the movement itself will keep ticking. It is a very robust movement. The SW200 has a strong legacy of robustness and ability to withstand like harsh conditions. That being said, we are actually pushing the boundaries a little bit with our new upcoming releases. I won't reveal too much information, but we are going to be going with a different movement manufacturer that's also based in Switzerland. And it's about giving people and customers the best bang for their buck. And we think that our new movement selections will improve the product line. They're going to make our customers a lot more happy. They're going to be modernized versions of the SW200 and 2824 standard. So we're really excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, and because I mean, the well, okay, I struggle with a lot of that stuff, but I know. With is it the N8 or NH that's the NH stuff that's like Seiko,
That's
correct?
Seiko, yeah.
Yeah, and because that's what you see a lot of companies popping up using that movement, and I'm like, all right, well, it's decent, but I've also had people tell me they have issues with those, like losing a bunch of time, and I'm like, okay, well, I don't know, I've never owned a Seiko unless I'm saying that, like, I don't even know what's in the glycine that I'm wearing, like, honestly, it probably could have a Seiko movement for all I know, and then I'm sitting here saying this stuff, but. I mean, it just, I think regardless of what of any of it, people do your research or crazy idea, reach out to the companies you're going to purchase from, like the bigger companies, Rolex, Omega, TAG, you maybe not get a response. I don't know how their customer service and staffing is, but certainly I think companies like yours, like you guys are dedicated to that and that's how you grow. Yeah. Put people at ease, answer the questions, transparency, like it's cool when you actually get that response going like, hey, totally normal question. We get this a lot. This is what you're looking at. 10 years, don't worry about it. You're going to be fine. If you have any issues, send it back. We'll take care of it. I think it's awesome.
No, I really appreciate it. Yeah, that's one thing we're trying to change. We're trying to improve the customer service experience. Again, like when you buy one of our watches, we really want it to feel like a reward for something you've accomplished or for that significant milestone. And again, you should be treated with respect because you're spending your hard-earned money to reward yourself. And I'm not sure what's happened recently, but it's not just, Rolex, it's other companies out there as well. And they turn away, hardworking people. And personally, I don't think that's right, right? Like, you've done a lot, you've accomplished a lot, and it's now time to reward yourself. And you should get the full backing of the company that you're buying from. So we will never turn away a customer. We will always answer your questions. We're always going to make sure someone's available to answer your questions. And if there's something wrong with a product that you've bought from us, we're going to always make it right. That's what you deserve. That is the minimum bar that we're setting for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think most people that are watch people, like I can only speak for myself, but I always enjoy it when people are like, hey, what kind of watch are you wearing? And you get to talk about it and like, oh yeah, it's great. I've had nothing but a three, like it's a fantastic experience. I think I've only owned maybe one or two watches where I was like, yeah, this thing's kind of a POS. Like I really wouldn't recommend it. I wore it because it matches the outfit or something like. But for the most part, I have pretty good luck with it. And I always love when people go, hey, man, nice watch. Like, what is that? And you get to tell them the story. especially if it's a maybe a little bit of a lesser known brand where you get to educate people a little bit and stuff like that. Unfortunately, I think there's still a lot of people out there. And I was one of these people that are like, oh, yeah, no big deal. It's a fossil. It's pretty sick. And you're like, that's not. that great of a watch. And I do have several Fossil watches that I do like the aesthetic of, but for a couple of years there, I was like, this is a really nice watch. And I learned a little bit and I'm like, this is not as nice as I thought it was. I still enjoy it, but I feel different. So.
No, I actually really like Fossil watches because I grew up during a time where every guy in high school had a Fossil watch,
Yeah.
and you just wanted to be a part of that crowd. I remember
You just
that.
wanted to do it. Yeah.
I really do hope Fossil comes back. I really respect that brand.
Yeah, it's yeah, I was definitely a part of my yeah, I'm thinking about that. Everybody in high school, that was like the nice watch that high school kids could afford because they were like 150 and under. And I wonder, I don't know, I'm gonna go look at that when we're done here. But at any rate, man, I have really enjoyed the conversation and appreciate the knowledge because I know a little bit. I do. I just obviously not anywhere close to what you do working in the industry in the space and running your own business, obviously, right? If people have questions, they want to reach out, or hopefully after listening to this, hearing the business values and they want to purchase one, where can they find you guys online? I know you have a website and I know you're on Instagram, but what is that for the listeners?
So if you guys want us to answer your questions, you want to reach out, it's just service@brigadewatches.com. You can message us through Facebook or Instagram. We always have someone supporting those two platforms. And if you want to directly make a purchase, our only form right now is our website. But if you, again, if you have questions prior to making your purchase, feel free to reach out to us. We're friendly people. We'll try to, answer anything you have. We'll try to support you. Send us a quick message. We'll always have someone there, to answer your questions.
Awesome. No, I mean, and seriously, and I have to say, I say this like either at the end of every interview or I do an outro and stuff. I tell people, I'm like, when guests are on here and they say reach out, that means it's okay to reach out. If it wasn't, like, because I'll inevitably get like eight people that are like, hey, do you know that whatever about whatever guest? I'm like, no. You could message them. They, I think. I would say 9.5 out of 10 guests always list that information. So if you guys have watch questions, there's an 80% or better chance that I will give you the wrong answer. So don't come to me. Reach out to Kevin and the guys at Brigade. They'll be able to give you a way more informed and educated, response. But man, I have really appreciated the time and the information. And hopefully we can do this again in the future and, connect and see how you guys have been doing and everything that's been going on with the company. So, with all that, man, thank you and we'll be in touch, man.
Perfect. Appreciate the time and thank you for having me on again. We'll do this again. It was fun. Thank you so much.
So for those of you guys that have been asking for this, like really, really cool opportunity to sit down with somebody who actually knows, I think, both sides of the discussion that many of us are trying to have. And I know certainly Kevin's not the only watch enthusiast with a military background out there, but certainly a really, really cool opportunity to talk to somebody as they're starting a company where they have the opportunity to like, address the issues and the problems that we have when we look at certain watches or timepieces. Just like, when we want to talk with somebody who works at an optics company or anything else where it's like, if I had the opportunity to have the discussion with somebody, I would ask these questions or I would point out why isn't this made better? Why isn't this handled differently? So not that I think that there's anything that is wrong with what Brigade's doing, obviously. What I'm saying is it is a great opportunity to sit here and gain understanding not only behind watches as a general tool and a general concept, but the manufacturing process behind it and where you can extend the life and longevity of your timepiece. So hopefully this was interesting for you guys. And if you're somebody who's reaching out to me or any of your friends going, hey, what is a tool watch? What's a dive watch? What kind of watch should I get? Because I get that question once in a while, mostly from my close friends. Like my brother reached out to me and he had questions about, what kind of a dive watch to get. And here's, hey, I can't really afford to spend more than this dollar amount. What brands should I look at? What brands should I not look at and things? Because there's a lot to it. Like we got into several different parts of the discussion around movements and quartz movements and things. And I think a lot of people like the automatics for the what they bring to the table, basically the feature set that they bring to the table. But quartz movements are fantastic and very accurate. Quartz movements also happen to be much more affordable, because they're just less to them. And hey, cool. If you want an automatic, get an automatic. Hey, if you want a quartz, get a quartz. Now, an automatic, you don't have to worry about the battery. A quartz movement, you do have to worry about the battery. It just, you know, not saying that one's better than the other, but take your pick. What do you need? What do you want? Go get it. So having Kevin sit down and walk through, you know, what he has seen, what he's experienced, you can tell that he's obviously done the work behind this. He understands the intricacies of both the watchmaking side and the engineering side. And what I really love about this is just hearing that the history that they've used as inspiration with some of those older style Rolexes, because I think that's what everybody chases when they say, I want a Rolex. Like, some people watch, you know, YouTube videos of current influencers and they go, oh, those guys were in the SEAL teams, I want what they have. And it's a little bit weird, you know, it's cool, but it's a little bit weird, whatever. I really like when you hear the stories behind some of those watches. When we read books like, you know, I mentioned this in the recording, like Jack Carr talking about James Reese and having his dad's watch, these like heirloom watches that are, you know, scratched up and a little bit beat up, but they're still running and they're still reliable and they have a story. And that's why I think that the tool watches are so cool, because they get banged up, they have scratches, they have character. And that's something that, you know, I think a lot of people, when they spend money on a timepiece, they spend their time and their energy trying not to scratch it up. And that's, and we talked about that, right? Kevin and I got into it. And we talked about, you know, hey, I won't wear my super expensive Omega or my Rolex out and about because I'm doing this stuff. Or he shared his stories about training, right? And just completely, you know, messing up that Rolex that he has. I get that. But if you have a watch where you can, A, wear it through all those things, develop that character, but still rely on it to be durable enough to get through the training, to take with you to classes and courses, to go out in the woods, to clear structures, to do breaching work and stuff, and know that, that's going to be along for the ride with you, that's a really, really cool concept. I mean, to me, that's what I look for. And I, so far, the watch that I'm wearing every day, it's a Glycine Combat Sub. It's been good for me. I don't do heavy training, you know, not to what you would consider for the military or law enforcement, certainly not out here doing breaching work, but it's been good for me for what I need. And it's got some dings, it's got some, you know, some scratches, whatever. Probably needs to be cleaned up pretty well. I'm due for a new NATO strap on it, but I love it because it's individual, it's unique. You don't see a ton of these. You know, Glycine's one of those companies that actually has a really, really long history in watchmaking. Unfortunately, they were bought by one of, I think, this is me talking, this is not Kevin, just to be very clear, I think one of the more despised brands in the watch industry right now, which is Invicta. and I don't need to get into why. If you understand, you do, and if you don't, you don't. But Glycine was purchased by them. Now, the Glycine as a brand still has a great history, and that's what I really liked about it, was they have history, they have a unique design, and I loved the watch. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to grab this, and I'm going to run with it, and I'm going to wear it every day, and it's going to be my watch. And the only time I'm not going to wear this is for special occasions when I happen to wear something a little bit more dressy, things like I'm probably not going to wear this to a wedding. I'll probably wear, you know, I have a nice Movado or something that's a little bit, it's a dress watch, you know, I'll wear that and it'll look a little bit sharper. But for my daily use, my courses, my classes, you know, human trafficking awareness range day trips and things like that, shout out to those guys, that's coming up at the end of the month. I'm going to be wearing this. And I think that feeling of, this is my watch, right? This is mine, and it has a story to tell, is a real big part of the allure. And to know that that's also in the virtue of what Brigade is trying to do as a company, I think that's fantastic, you guys. And I would implore you to at least look into what they have going on, because there are tons and tons and tons of, you know, shady watch companies out there that are doing this gimmick and that gimmick, you know, oh, build your own watch, where they're basically just putting stuff together in a box and shipping it out to you at an inflated price. And if that's the experience you want, cool. If you're into that thing, cool. A lot of people are not. I happen to be one that is not. And a lot of people are just buying, you know, prefabbed cases and bracelets and crystal and stuff, and they're just white labeling everything and they're selling it as their own, and you have very little customer support. Like, cool, just understand, when you cut corners and save money on your purchase, that's the kind of support you're getting. So if you're able to look at a company like Brigade, that you just heard it from one of the founding, you know, or one of the founders, one of the owners, that their mission is to not be that, and specifically go into detail about the choices they're making to avoid being that, I think that's a special thing. you know, I'm not just saying that because obviously Kevin was one of the people that I invited on the podcast. So hopefully it was insightful, or at least, you know, these kind of things are very interesting. They're, it's a step and a half off the beaten path of training and preparedness, but still something that I think is really relevant to our space when you got guys like, you know, Joe Dawson from Bruiser Industries, right? Joe's a watch guy. I love seeing his watch stuff on Instagram, or Watches of Espionage on Instagram, or Chris Blau, right, with 1911 Syndicate. I really need to reconnect with Chris, but he's a watch guy too. I know he did a YouTube video probably a couple of years back now on Panerai watches, which is really, really cool, and has a military history behind it that I just loved hearing about. So there's a lot to this stuff. It's a big part of our community, and I just loved it. I love being able to sit down and talk about this and hear about it. So I hope you guys did too. But that's all I got for you guys. Thank you guys so much for sticking around this far and listening to our discussion, hanging out and listening to this week's, you know, episode. We got more on the way next week. We'll have a sit rep coming up too, you know, first Sunday of September, with not too many left in 2025. But as we're rolling into fall, we'll have a sit rep coming, and then next week, more big fun, guys. So thank you so much for checking this out. Until next time, you guys stay safe out there, and like we always say here, work hard, train smarter, and be prepared.